You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 388. What a brutal day on the markets. On the podcast today, I have Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, Simon French, talking macro, Harry Adams, Executive Chairman of Keffi Minerals, Private Investor Riddler, and Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talking about the macro scene. Plus, he also focuses in on Renewron, R-E-N-E. Worth a listen. And by all means, have a guess. In a day that all is hammered again, go to voxmarkets.co.uk/ops, O-P-S, that is, for a guess in our oil price sweepstake. It's close of play tomorrow at 4:30. Submit your last guess at 4:30, and we'll take the price at midday on Friday. If you are spot on with that guess, then you win that prize in cash. If no one guesses it, it's a rollover. Doesn't get more exciting than that, does it?
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon. It's Simon French. Thanks for joining me, Simon.
Good afternoon, Justin.
Now, what a bloodbath. What is happening with the markets? We see, I'm looking at the FTSE is down by 3%. Oil is, of course, hitting lows again. So is this a temporary thing, Simon? Is this a seasonality? Or are we headed? I mean, because I've heard the big R word mentioned more than one or two times, the recession. Are we heading to recession, or is this just seasonality? What's happening here?
No, it's we're not heading for a recession as things stand, Justin. What we're seeing is the third major collapse in equity prices over the last 6 months. And the first one back in, if you remember, back in August was due to the surprise move from the People's Bank of China, who devalued the yuan against the dollar. The second one was ahead of the Fed's move in December, that first US interest rate rise in pretty much 9 years. And then this is the third time that equity markets have been hit. What's the justification? Well, for my mind, it's not due to a global recession or even a UK recession. What we're seeing is the second order impacts of that massive bust in the commodity price, both oils and basic materials. A lot of the sovereign wealth funds that built up assets, specifically equities, so in the good times, are now having to liquidate their positions to try and balance their government's budgets. And, you know, we should welcome that, because actually that's good hedging from their position. But the problem is for unwary investors expecting the impact of the commodity bust to be confined to the oil majors and the mining stocks. It's gone much wider this time, and I expect that selling pressure to continue for some sessions to come.
Yeah, so, and it didn't help, I suppose. Yesterday we had the IMF downgrading global growth, and we had the IAE come out, and one of the quotes that sticks in my head is, we are in danger of drowning in oil. I mean,
absolutely.
Is that the case?
Well, it is actually at the moment, because we were already at almost unprecedented levels of surplus in terms of supply outstripping demand ahead of Iran coming on back onto the international markets. And there's suggestions that Iran may start to pump anything between 500,000 and 800,000 additional barrels per day by the end of 2016. And therefore, the IEA's rhetoric is probably going to be backed up by reality. And this is a time when the IMF, you rightly mentioned their report yesterday, they reported the growth is expected at 3.4%, which is definitely not the R word. It is definitely not a global recession. But what it is a slowing in demand, which will reduce the draw on OPEC and non-OPEC oil, just meaning that disparity between supply and demand that we've had for more than a year now is just going to continue ever longer. So against that backdrop, investors will be wary. And, you know, it's not just the IMF, it's not just the IEA. We've also had, you know, Mark Carney yesterday pretty much telling the UK consumer that interest rates are going to be on hold for the whole of the year. We've had warnings at Davos. We've had stuff from the Chancellor here in the UK warning that there are risks from emerging markets and the huge amount of dollar-denominated debt that a lot of them have borrowed against. So the mood music is not positive, and therefore investors can be forgiven perhaps for expecting a recession on the horizon. But there is a mismatch here between that rhetoric and what actually you're seeing in the macro data.
Yeah, but as far as the markets go, I don't know if you look at charts or anything, and I mean, do you have an opinion on how low the FTSE can go realistically before people start thinking, hang on, this is overdone? I mean, are we overdone today? Like I said, January for the last couple of years has never been a particularly good month for equities anyway, I think, but this is the worst ever. And are we likely to see a seasonal recovery as we go through to April?
Yeah, so the FTSE 100 is no more than about 20 points away from bear market territory. Typically, we would get bear markets with a domestic recession. As I said, you know, back into my last answer, you don't actually get recessions with unemployment at the rate it is, consumer spending growing, retail sales growing 5% year on year. A question on how low the FTSE can go. FTSE 100, quite interestingly, that a lot of that will be dependent on what happens on commodity prices, specifically the oil price this year. Very, very difficult. I mean, my own view is the FTSE will end the year about 5,800, which was down on the start of the year, but actually up from where we are right now. And that's because earnings growth I expect to be flat this year, consistent with the pattern in the FTSE over the last three and a half to four years. Of course, if you look wider, you look at the FTSE 250, so more of a domestic play, it's quite some way. It's about 1,100 points off being in no bear markets. But I think that's more in keeping with where we are right now. We're in a slowing global economy with earnings growth fairly limited and with re-rating having taken place thanks to quantitative easing, and some of that starting to unwind. So equity markets near flat from this point to the end of the year for me, but the big uncertainty being the degree to which commodity prices snap back.
Okay, and you don't see this. I see it, you know, often you see conspiracy theories or theories coming out about this QE will unwind at some stage and China's going to implode and all this. And you don't see the doomsday scenario happening, do you?
Well, there's two parts to that question. Let's take QE first up. Undoubtedly, one of the impacts of QE was to drive up asset prices, along with reducing lending costs. And as the US, which still remains the predominant central bank, the Fed remains the predominant central bank in markets, starts to very, very gradually tighten rates, the impact of that wealth effect that boosted up asset prices will start to unwind. But we've got to remember the BOJ, the ECB, and probably the PBOC are going to be in stimulus mode for all of 2016. And that is a nice counterweight to tighter money in the US. In terms of China, China's still growing 6.9% according to the data that was out yesterday. Even if you don't believe that data and you look at some read across from the PMIs, then it's still firmly in growth territory, with lending growing at 15% year on year, public sector spending growing at 28% year on year. They have a lot of policy tools to throw at a slowing economy. So for me, a fairly soft landing in China, but undoubtedly a landing. It's not going to be the era of 7, 8, 9, 10% growth that we've been used to for 20 years. And therefore, investors have just got to adjust to that reality.
Yeah, so essentially, it's a bit more optimistic than because obviously the market sentiment does capture. We get enveloped with it really, and we think, oh no, doomsday scenario. So you're saying it's not batten down the hatches. It's more stand back a little bit and maybe look for some bargains. Is that right?
Well, it's boring to be boring, isn't it? But sometimes boring is actually a fair reflection of where we are in markets, with with credit conditions still very accommodative, households still feeling the impact, most of them, from lower cost of servicing their mortgages, lower cost of filling up their cars. For me, that makes some bargains to be had in the consumer services sector, in the technology sector, also in the telecom space. Those three sectors that traditionally, when the Fed has tightened and the rest of the world has been loosening, those are the three sectors that have outperformed. And for me, with all boats sinking on days like today, that presents some valuation mismatches, and it'll be those sectors that stand to benefit from those households that are feeling better off. Those are the ones I'd be wanting to look for those bargains in.
Marvellous. Well, nice to see there's a silver lining on today's bloodbath. Simon, thanks for joining me. Thanks very much, fella.
My pleasure.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Harry Adams, Executive Chairman of Keffi Minerals. Thanks for coming on, Harry.
Pleasure. Nice to be here.
Now, as quite a few private investors said, can you get someone from Keffi Minerals on? Quite a few people out there very enthusiastic about your company. So people who don't know about the company, Harry, give us a broad outline as to what you do.
Well, we're a group of people from the mining industry, mainly from Australia, but also from some other countries, who've set ourselves up in around North Africa and Middle East, specifically focusing on a particular part of the geology there called the Arabian-Nubian Shield. We see it as an emerging gold and base metals province, which will at some point in the not too distant future rival some of the larger mining zones from Australia. That's the geography that we're focused on. The countries are Ethiopia and Saudi Arabia, two of the more pro-development and prospective jurisdictions in that geology. And the particular projects we're focused on are one discovery in Saudi Arabia and one acquisition in Ethiopia. We've been opportunistic, you might say, to get set in this, I suppose, buyer's market, this low point of the cycle, and draw great people together from a great team to tackle gold and base metals. Now we have a development to start a cash flow, and we also have a very high upside on some of the targets we're looking at.
Yeah, so at what point in the cycle are you with these assets, Harry?
Well, in terms of the asset cycle, the main project is the Tulu Kapi Gold Project in Ethiopia, which we bought 2 years ago, I would say, in a reasonably ripe condition for development, but it needed to be overhauled as regards its development plan, which we've done. So now we're at the stage where it is actually quite ready to go. We've fully permitted it, contracted it with the large mining contractors and plant builders from Australia, leaders in their field internationally, including in Africa. The government's joined us as a partner in the project, and we're now finalising the banking and associated financing syndicate members. So we'll be in construction in the second half of the year and all the financing drawn down by the middle of the year.
Okay, and what's the size of these assets, Harry?
Well, the Tulu Kapi project I just mentioned is a 2 million ounce resource, 1 million ounce reserve today, and we'll be producing just short of 1 million ounces based on what you'd call, say, banker's numbers. But based on what we see there, it would be unlikely to produce at least double that, to produce at least 2 million ounces over a period of time, not just from the banker's numbers, if you like, because there's a known deposit underneath the open pit that the bankers have ignored at this stage, and there are satellite deposits around it that we need to work up before we can start development planning. So Tulu Kapi, just by itself, we see it as over $2 billion worth of gold to come out, and its costs of production are expected to be in the lowest quartile globally. So we think that'll be a good money spinner. And the projects over in Saudi Arabia actually dwarf it, but they're much less advanced and need to be worked up further.
I see. And as far as the life cycle of the mine, how long will it take? I mean, how long will you be working there for?
Oh, we're starting construction towards the end of the year and being up and running at the end of the following year. So just at the end of next year, we'll be in production. And the bankers see it as a 9-year project based on the proven reserves of the open pit. And we see it as an additional 5 to 10 years based on the underground and the satellite deposits that need to be built up.
Wow, and there's actually $2 billion there, and we're talking about what, at the moment, you're about an 8 million market cap company?
8 million pounds market cap. Yeah, the markets are shocking at the moment, and I suppose it's been a risk-off market for most, and the gold sector, particularly the juniors, has languished like many other sectors.
Yeah, okay, let's have a couple of questions from private investors. Here's the first one. The company looks like a takeover target at this market cap, especially as the DFS is now completed. What's your thoughts?
Well, without wanting to make too much of it in any formal sense, I don't think I've ever been approached by so many people wanting to buy an asset as we've had recent approaches for Tulu Kapi, because it's pretty obvious to everybody that it's being set up very well and it's going to go forward. I would say that Plan A is develop and yield the fruits of our labour, and Plan B would be to accept an offer too good to refuse. But that's not what we're going out focusing on. We're focusing on delivering what we've set out to deliver to the government, to the community, to the shareholders. But it is a public company, and you know, one can't control all these things. It's a function of what the markets determine is the best outcome in the long term.
Yeah, okay, cool. Another question here. If gold is $1,100 an ounce, how long will it take to pay back the initial capital borrowed?
From the start of production, about 3 years, something like that. I haven't got that number in front of me, but it'd be about 3 years.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, and next question. The company will make $20 million free cash flow at gold at $1,100. The company only traded 8 million market cap. How are you going to get the price up, especially as other explorers are trading at big premium to Kefi, despite your company looking far more attractive on paper?
Well, most of the sector, in fact, has fared terribly over the last few years, and this company is no exception. In fact, I think approximately half to two-thirds of the companies in this listed sector internationally have actually shut up shop over the last few years. Now, how does the share price go up? I mean, we are the managers of the company, and the share price is not something we drive ourselves. But what we will do is to deliver on the plans we've set out. And I suppose my take on it is that because most companies can't get projects like ours financed because they don't have the same economics as ours, There's probably an innate skepticism or conservatism from the point of view of the share trader in whether it can get financed, particularly people who are perhaps, you know, not so familiar with all the nuances of financing. I think that as we announce the rest of the financing syndicate, I think a lot of those vagaries and mystiques will go away, and the share price will probably adjust accordingly. But, you know, that remains to be seen, but that's what I would have thought.
Okay, and what is the situation with finance? Where are you as far as finance is concerned?
Well, the contractors are contributing about $40 million odd in the way we're running those contracts. The government, $15 to $20 million. The next cab off the rank is the banks, and that looks like it's coming together this month for formal appointments. And then the last cab off the rank is the gold stream piece, or the product linked financing, which is also being worked on now that we've sort of settled on the banks, and that'll come together, I think, next month. So we're in the final throes, really, of formalising the syndicate. That's why I'm travelling around so much, just eyeballing the heads of these companies and making the final choices.
Okay, cool. Next question. We had a fund selling out in the past few months. Has there been any interest from any other large funds looking to build a stake? Do you plan to present to any in the near future?
Yeah, a fund did sell out of all junior AIM stocks. As far as I'm aware, I've heard of quite a few others who just got sold out at the same time. And in respect of the meeting other funds, yes, we're increasing the tempo on the investor relations now that this is all going ahead. And in fact, I'm going to the industry get together in South Africa in a few weeks' time, and we'll be meeting quite a number of investment funds there, you know, to look at building relationships as we have done in the past, sort of get involved with the company over time. The largest shareholder in the company is OD Asset Management in the UK already. The second largest shareholder is the largest gold contractor in Australia, Ausdrill, and the board are the next largest shareholder. So we already have very strong shareholders, and our partners in Saudi Arabia are shareholders as well in KEFI. So, you know, we're in the business of building relationships, as we have with the government, who's a partner in the project now in Ethiopia.
Okay. Put your tin hat on and flak jacket for this one, Harry. This is the hardest question you're going to have. The one but last question. It says, Tuesday's news of the granting more share options for the board will be seen by long-suffering shareholders as a disgrace, a board taking advantage of a decimated share price due to the selling down by Standard Life as a way to line their own nest by granting options at a bargain basement price. Don't you think shareholders will feel you're showing a total lack of ambition by having the option price so low?
Well, I can't control the feelings of every individual. That's obviously the case. But all I can say is that the share option scheme was approved by all shareholders in general meeting. I don't remember anyone putting their hand up and complaining about the scheme that was approved by shareholders to issue up to 10% of issued capital in the form of share options. We've, after the announcement earlier this week of the grant of more options to senior people, the total on issue is 6%, not 10%, so it's well under what the shareholders approved. And the options were issued at 30-odd percent premium over the VWAP.
Yeah, I think it's 33%, yeah.
So, we're just complying with the rules as approved by shareholders, and they're not exercisable unless and until the project's up and running at Tulu Kapi. There's a couple of conditions there that the project has to get up and running on spec for the options to be exercisable. So, you know, the people who work in the company are hard-driven people. Lacking ambition, I would take affront to. I think one doesn't build a mine in a jurisdiction where we're the first internationally financed mine in Ethiopia and work in remote locations the way we do, managing startup risks and international financing risk. One doesn't do that unless one has ambition. And the incentivization plan is a part of the shareholder-approved method of remuneration. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, well, that's a good answer, Harry. Last one. How do you compare to other gold producers like Caledonia Mining, Trans-Siberian Gold? I'm not quite sure what they mean by that. They mean costs? I've no idea. But make that what you will.
I can't pretend to know those particular companies, and I'd rather not compare with specifics. What I can say is that when I said earlier that I've never had so many approaches by people interested in buying a project off us, because clearly they see that the stock market doesn't appreciate or respond to the results to date and has yet to value the project in a way which is any sort of recognition of the value there. So clearly they see it as an opportunity to get involved. And what do they see when they look at Tulu Kapi? And when they look at Kefi Minerals, because some of them want to take control of Kefi Minerals if they were given the opportunity, what they see in Tulu Kapi is a robust project with a fair bit of upside, with unit costs worked out by industry-leading professionals and signed off by independent professionals as being in the lowest quartile in the world. So it's a neat, robust project in a jurisdiction of Ethiopia which is pro-development and permitted us without a glitch, and has much potential for exploration. That's what they see in Tulu Kapi, and I think what they see in Kefi is a company that's established a platform and an intellectual property led by a bunch of decent people in the Arabian-Nubian Shield, which some people at least recognise that area, that geology on the two sides of the Red Sea, will be a gold producer no less significant than Australia is today. But it'll take time, obviously, to make the discoveries and the developments. But Tulu Kapi is a particularly ripe one, ready to go.
Marvellous. Well, Harry, that's all the questions. So if you could sum up sort of in three bullet points as to why someone should think about investing in Kefi Minerals.
I would say the assets, the upside and the timing are all being managed by a very, very good team. In terms of the assets, the startup of Tulu Kapi will be in NPV terms more than a five bagger just based on bankers' numbers. The NPV at the start of production late next year is $150 to $200 million, depending which assumptions you use. And today's market cap's under $15 million US, or about $15 million US. The upside doesn't include those numbers. Don't include the underground mine or the satellite deposits around it, and the larger targets, indeed in Saudi Arabia. We just don't see Tulu Kapi less than doubling. And Saudi will dwarf what we're doing in Ethiopia at the moment. In terms of timing, I just have not seen better fundamental value or better upside at Kefi than we have today, and yet the share price is the lowest it's ever been. So, from that point of view, it's an opportunity. The volatility in markets generally makes gold a necessary investment, in my opinion, because of the upside in the gold price. And I think that gets, if you like, leveraged up through the Kefi stock. And I think I have to say that the people in the company are terrific. You know, the exploration director is a proven mine finder, Jeff Rayner. The MD in Ethiopia, Wayne Nicoletta, is a proven mine builder in Africa, and everyone's got skin in the game. They're well incentivized, and they work flat out, right through. We work right through Christmas. We've all been flat out continually, and we're making this a reality. And we've been backed by second to none backers, OD Asset Management, the Ethiopian government, Ausdrill, Sedgman's the plant builder, and soon we'll be announcing the bankers as well. So I think that, you know, this is about the best moment that I've seen in the company for an investment.
Wow, well, I asked for three, but you gave me more than my values for money's worth there, Harry. So, you know, and if your project is anything to go by like that, that was it's going to be, you know, a good investment. So, Harry, thank you very much for coming on. You seem like you've got a very exciting asset there and a very exciting couple of years ahead of you. But listen, please do come back on when you have some more news.
That's a pleasure. Thanks very much for giving me the chance to speak to you. Thanks, bye.
Cheers, Harry. Thanks very much. I'll put that on the podcast this afternoon and... while you were talking there, I did put your company on a watch list of stocks of mine. So I'll be looking to buy, I think, if I do a bit more research. And if you know, there we are. So thanks very much for coming on.
Okay, thank you, Justin. See you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waits.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You're right, Al.
Hello, Jess. Yeah, I'm okay. It's a bit of a bloody day on the markets.
It's a blood bath. Yeah,
3%, 6.698 as we're speaking. It's a pretty horrible old day.
Yeah, it's almost like they're pricing in a recession. You know, because like I said, I'm looking at I was looking at a 3 year. In fact, we're now below we were 3 years ago in the FTSE. And to me, even that says surely chance of a rebound there somewhere. You know, even if it's 5,500 level. Again, they're at 5,000. That is like a 5-year low, you know, on the FTSE, which is nuts. So, I know Royal Dutch Shell came up with the results today, and their earnings are obviously down. But I'm big into Royal Dutch Shell. I'm still holding them because their 8% dividend has been guaranteed by the CEO for the rest of this year. And I may even want to stabilise it a little bit, maybe, you know, average down again, even though I reinvest the dividend, and it sort of averages down for me.
Yep.
I think, but no, I think there's plenty of time, you know, and like I said, I think we'll, you know, in about 3 years' time, probably it'll take a while to work its way through the system, this supply glut, but I think we'll be saying, God, I should have piled into old stocks back then. You know, that's hopefully what will happen, you know?
I agree. I think when we spoke last time, I'd actually pulled out of the big stocks. I'd sort of sold everything and was sitting on the sidelines. But I jumped back in last week and didn't touch energy stocks. I just went in with a very defensive... in fact, I've been looking at what other fund managers have been buying, and a lot of the biggest holdings are in Imperial Tobacco. So I went to, I'm into IMT, Legal & General, also a very good performer. Vodafone, of course, you know, a lot of brokers are saying that's going to go to 280p this year. You know, great earnings, you know, a great company overall, very defensive play. And also sort of... have gone into I didn't pull completely out of energy stocks. I thought Anglo American so bombed out, I had a little punt in that, so that's sort of that's obviously up and down like a yo-yo, but it's not really affecting the overall valuation too much. But it's very difficult. But you know, with Shell now below £13 a share, I mean, it's got to be a fantastic opportunity at some point. And you know, I think we were saying earlier that the dividend's been guaranteed. Although the results haven't been great today, the dividend's been guaranteed for the rest of the year. So if you're looking for a payout and prepared to ride the volatility, it's got to be a great play right now.
Yeah, and do you know what? All the producers are hurting at this level. It's not like, you know, there's some people willing to... I mean, Iran, I know, has come online now. They're saying they're running at starting with 300,000 barrels a day. Ironically, you know, sort of the US came off. I mean, the rig count has gone down in the US, and they're saying they're going to... This end of this year, it'll be 600,000 barrels a day less coming from North America. But yet you've got Iran now saying they can pump from 300,000 up to sort of around about 500,000. So that's almost replacing that lost supply.
Yeah,
but I think, you know, after a while, I think something will have to be done. The oil producers are hurting. Everyone is. And so a stand will have to be made somewhere along the line. And, you know, who knows when that will be, but it'll take a bit more of hurt yet. I think this is going to be longer for lower, or lower for longer, I should say. Anyway, so let's try and ignore the pain of the macro. What are you looking at on a micro level there, Al?
Well, on a micro level, just we've spoken about this company before. It's a company called Reneuron. The epic code is R-E-N-E. Based in Guildford in Surrey, so not too far from where I live. Stem cells therapy company. They have about 80 patents issued worldwide, and they specialize in stem cell therapy to treat stroke disability, blindness, critical limb ischemia, and they're using the technology to help assisting cures for these conditions, and also they've developed what they call nanoparticles that are secreted by stem cells as potential new drug candidates to target a range of cancers too. So it's a terrific company. Last July, they had a placing, and the placing was oversubscribed. They raised $68.5 million at 5p a share. Today, the shares are 2.9p, so they're way below that placing level. Invested into this company also is Neil Woodford, the well-regarded fund manager, Invesco, Abingworth. It's got a raft of major shareholders. Now the company is investing all the money it's raised into developing stem cell technology. It's recently secured received approval from the FDA for one of its treatment courses in the US, and it announced last week that it had received a $2.1 million grant from Innovate UK to further develop its therapies. It's a great company. It's trading well below the fundraise level last year. The big investors are still invested. This company's got so much going for it, and at this level, it's got to be a great opportunity.
Yeah, well, do you know, I was into Renewal a while back, and I bought, when was this? Almost last year, I think it was. I'm looking at the chart, trying to figure out when it was. And I bought it about, where was it buying? I bought it around about 3p, I think, and they shot up. And they doubled, and I did sell pretty much, and it went a bit further. I thought, oh, I've sold those too early. They went to just over 6p, and they started coming back down then. And they recently hit lows, didn't they? In fact, I got an email from someone saying, what's happening to Renewron? And they went down to a low of 2.375. Yep. They've bounced a bit. Now, they've come back down again with the market at 2.875. Yeah, I've just put a price alert on these at 2.5p, I think. And I think, to see if it will retest that low. Because if it does, I don't think it'll go any lower. Like I said, it's got a lot of backing. Yep. It's got funds there, and it's a good company. So it's definitely one to keep an eye on. And I did a bit of research on this last year. I should dig that out with a blog post and what I wrote about it. Because, I did like it at the time. But it's always one of the things. You need to put these in the watch list because you forget about them. And then you realise, oh, hang on, this is a good company. There, let's go back and look at that. So yeah, I'm gonna.
That's the thing. You look at the 2.9p. Next thing you know, they're sort of 7p. You know, it's very easy to miss this. So it's as you say, if you can pick it up. I mean, even at this level, at this level now, if you can pick some up, have a small punt, put it away, tuck it away in a drawer. This company is going places. Singer, their broker, has got had a buy rating all the way through, 6.2p target last year, and it raised its price target to 10p. So the broker's a big fan, and but the best endorsement for me is the amount of fund managers that are involved in the stock. There's some really big holders there, so it's well supported, and I'm sure the fund managers at some point we'll take advantage of these low prices to top up.
Exactly, but at the moment in this market, it's almost scared to dip your foot in now because I do think it'll go a bit lower. So I think this now, if you've got a bit of cash on the sidelines, it's good to set price alerts because it's starting to become a buyer's market. And that's the way the stock market works. It gets to the point where everything's fallen so fast, and you think, wow, some bargains out there, and people don't want to miss out on making money because that's the driving force behind any investment, obviously. And you will start seeing people jumping back in sooner or later, wouldn't you?
Well, it is, and I think as we said earlier with Shell, if you're prepared to accept the volatility that comes with owning that stock at these levels, the dividend's guaranteed for the rest of the year. So if you hold it for the rest of the year and the share price does nothing or drops a bit, you've still got a fantastic return guarantee from the dividend. So it's almost a no-brainer. But people will also be looking and say it's catching a falling knife at the moment, surely. So there is that risk. How much lower will the oil price go? It's one of the best companies in the world, Shell. It's paid a dividend every year since the Second World War.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous, Al. Hopefully we'll be looking back on this podcast in a couple of years' time thinking, oh, I should have really gone big time on that.
Exactly.
And that's the trouble. With fear, the old Warren Buffett saying, where there's fear in the market, it's time to be greedy, and that's the way forward, I think, long as you do your research, as I'm saying.
Yeah.
Marvellous, Al. Thanks for that. It's Renewron, R-E-N-E. Thanks, Al.
Thanks, Jess. All the best. Cheers. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is successful private investor, Riddler. You all right, fella?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, Justin. How are you? It's been a, you know, we eased into the post Christmas markets. I think everyone had a bit of a full belly and perhaps a bit too much turkey, but there seems to be a bit of energy and life in the markets this last sort of 6 or 7 days, doesn't there?
Well, do you know what? Energy, yes, but almost energy on the wrong side, going downwards. And like I said, it was reported the worst ever week for a start of a year ever. And I suppose we've seen a bit of stability, yesterday. But, you know, will this be, you know, long-lived? I don't know, because there's a lot of uncertainty out there, isn't there? Especially like China, for example. I mean, it seems to me China now is a huge economy. And even though they come out with their GDP of 6.9% growth, a lot of people aren't happy with that. But essentially, like I said, I posted a tweet out saying, yeah, but you know, they're 10 times as big an economy now as they were in 1998. So it's going to be hard for them to keep expanding, you know, at a double digit rate or even high single digits. But what do you think about China? You know, and what can China do? Because at the moment they're trying everything. The stock market is very volatile, and there's a bit of panic there, and that does send a few shockwaves around the world. What do you think the Chinese should do about this? Because they're sort of new to this thing, aren't they? They come from a command economy. They're trying to be a bit of a free market economy. And they're almost like their foot is in the swimming pool. It's half out. They don't know what to do, do they? But what do you think the Chinese should do? Because everyone's sort of worrying about China.
Well, it's funny. It's almost like a bit of a contradiction, Justin, because we are all focused on China, but most sensible commentators don't believe any of the data that comes out of there. So there's a huge disconnect with what the Chinese officials are releasing as their data. And if you look at their last sort of 6 quarters of growth, it's just too steady and too convenient. I think it ranges, you know, for an economy the size of China, I think it ranges between about 6.8% and 7.2% for 6 consecutive quarters. So I think the problem is almost people don't believe the data anymore. They do not believe what's happening there. So there's a huge disconnect between the perception that China is really struggling. And I think it is, you know, it's got over leveraged in terms of manufacturing and commodities. It's got over capacity, but the sort of demand is falling. So I think that's the first issue, the disconnect. And that's in a sort of microcosm has been shown with the, some of the strange delistings of Chinese companies. There's definitely a corporate governance issue with the Chinese companies that have moved away to AIM. So I think the first thing it needs to do is just really sort out officially what line it's going to take. Is it going to try and smooth out its data, or is it going to really reveal the real true nature of China's economy, which is hugely lumpy, and as you would expect for the second largest economy in the world. And I remember when people were investing in the sort of mid-2000s, everyone was talking about the BRIC countries, you know, Brazil, Russia, yeah, India and China. And it's almost like, well, India hasn't really sort of been the safe haven that people thought it was. And so I think what China needs to do personally, it needs to get more inward investment. At the minute it's quite self-reliant. It has got a thriving sort of financial and service sector, but it's sort of almost servicing itself at the minute. I think if it opened up its doors politically and on a corporate level, and then financially, I think people would embrace China. It wants to be open, but on the other hand seems to keep a lot of its data to itself, and certainly a lot of its political and organizational issues are well documented. So it is a big powerhouse. We know that it's been heavily reliant on commodities and on oil, and since those two sectors have fallen, so has the Chinese economy in tandem with that. So it really is it's a dangerous sort of impasse that we've got at the minute with China. But I do think if it did some really good inward investment and started to open up its doors to some sort of Western companies rather than just a lip service investment, I think China could still be a really strong bet for the next 10 years.
Yeah, it's funny though, you talk about the BRICS though. I mean, and of those countries, Brazil and Russia pretty much in recession. India is almost, for a powerhouse, it doesn't seem to have the clout that China does, even though it's, you know, it's 1.2 billion population. China's 1.3 billion, so it's not far behind. And people are saying now that economy could, you know, overtake China. And do you know the funny thing is, no one ever, I've never heard anyone say that actually China's expanding faster than 6.9%. I mean, I've heard ranges from they're in recession to about to about sort of 6%, you know? You never hear any figures higher than the actual stated, you know, official figure from China. So I think there's something, you know, dodgy going on there, but it's hard to know what to believe. But I suppose, you know, we can judge it. I know they're trying to go from an export-driven economy to basically a service economy, and they're saying this will be, you know, quite volatile while this is happening. But you can judge in what's happening to the surrounding economies, and especially the big miners that supply, you know, China, like you said, the oil producers who have seen this downturn, you know, unbelievable. But I mean, talking about, you know, commodities, oil, and I know you're quite bearish on oil, and you've been here for a while. So what do you think about this? We've hit sort of in lows. I think it was a 16-year low 2 days ago on the overnight market. 16-year low in oil. I mean, is this the bottom? Do you think, obviously, this is a billion-dollar question. But what do you see? Do you see good news for oil?
Well, I've sort of stuck by my original sort of first two podcasts that I didn't see anything to shout and scream about, even if oil was to bounce to 40. I still believe that whatever point oil bottoms out officially, so you're looking at, you know, consecutive weeks where it doesn't post a new low, just to do a very basic chartist point of view, you know, in any chart, you want it to have a couple of weeks where it's performed no new low and maybe even consolidated in a new higher range. So I'll be looking for oil to sort of perhaps hit 23, 24, consolidate. So I do think that still there's going to be a massive time lag between the time in which oil bottoms, which may be a time issue as in February or March, it might be a price issue, which may be 23, 24. But I've said on my podcast and I've said on Twitter that I want to see all of the corporate earnings and releases by all the major oil companies first, because that will give us a true state of the health of the oil industry. We know that it's suffering. We can see it's suffering. We've seen the cutbacks from BP and the North Sea oil field producers. But I would rather wait longer than look for some arbitrary figure. Well, there it is. Oil's bottomed at 23. Therefore, all of a sudden, oil companies become a buy. They don't. I think the worst is yet to come. I think we'll hit the bottom with oil about a month and a half or 2 months before we'll hit the bottom with oil stocks. Because as we saw with Ithaca Energy, you know, that was the first major, I mean, Premier Oil as well, but they're the first two real major companies to be reporting their earnings and their financial health, and the market reacted badly to both. Yeah. So, long story short, I'm looking for all the companies to report and then I'll assess my view, but my view is still that there's going to be a lot of companies going bust, there's going to be a lot of covenants broken, there's going to be a lot of difficulties refinancing debt for the larger companies as well. And I'd be looking to be seriously casting my eye over oil companies once the dust has settled in sort of March time.
Yeah, and it's funny, I read a note out from the IAE, and I think it was a spokesman or someone involved with that, saying that the world is in danger. It's a bit of a dramatic headline of a drowning in oil, because it said basically what Saudis have done is, you know, they've ramped up production and they have so successfully almost, you know, taken out a big part of the North American shale. But the trouble is now, and they said pretty much that they'll take out around about 600,000 barrels a day from North American producers. But the trouble is now, Iran is coming online and they're going to be producing 500,000 anyway. And they said Iran, you know, because they've had a load of oil supplied stored for a long time, they'll be willing to supply cheaper than anyone, you know, because they just want to get the economy going again. So, you know, you've got one source coming off and one source coming on. So it's, it's going to take a while, I think. And I see an extended, you know, lower for longer, definitely. And I honestly think the bounce will happen, but I think we'll come back almost a dead cat bounce. I think we'll retest, you know, that low again. So I think everyone will see a rally in oil, think, oh, this is the recovery, and I think we will come back and test that. I don't know why I think that's going to happen. I think it'll almost a sucker punch, you know?
Yeah, well, I think skillful CFD traders and spread bettors, they could make quite a lot of money. You know, if oil was to touch the low 20s and there was a bounce, you know, you could make a lot of money on the leveraged products. But whether oil bounces to 30 or 35 or 40, the financial health of the companies I've described before,
yeah,
what won't benefit at all from that is just going to prolong the agony that they're currently under. So oil companies is still a big no for me. And it's funny, I mean, America spent a lot of the 60s and 70s, you know, finding wells, plugging and abandoning them, and then trying to sort of bankrupt Russia, you know, the old Cold War foe of the 70s. And it's funny that when America was trying to get back online in the 2000s with the shale gas industry, in its own way has led to the overproduction and oversupply. You could see the attraction when oil was $90 and $95. You could see the attraction of investing heavily in the shale gas industry and for America to be, you know, not reliant on any exporter. We saw the problems with Venezuela that it had under Chavez, you know, sort of 8-9 years ago. And like you say now, you know, with Iran and the Saudis, the overproduction in America. Having said that, you can always judge when we might be close to a turning point when the newspapers come out with ridiculous statements. I remember them doing the same with house prices, you know, in 2008, that, you know, house prices will collapse by another 50%. And they were talking about these huge household names like Persimmon going out of business. And I read one headline, I think it was last week from the, I think it was the Telegraph, you know, oil at £10 a, you know, sorry, $10 a barrel. And I think when they start coming up with those claims, it's a bit like when they claim that gold was going to $2,500 back in 2008. I think that's usually the time that there's a turning point. I remember the famous quote, I think it might have been Buffett, but he was saying that, you know, when my shoe shine boy is giving me advice on stocks and shares, you know that there's a turning point. And I think it's that same sort of anecdote that people are now claiming that £10, $5 a barrel. So I think that we're nearly there. I think we're nearly there, but I'd like to see that that reporting cycle done first.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've been on sort of Twitter for a while, and but you mainly your main sort of stomping ground there for chatting was bulletin boards. And you're still on there, are you?
Yeah, yeah. Still do the bulletin boards now and again. Do LSE. Predominantly, really.
I've never really. Every now and again, I do go. I don't really, you know. If I'm trying to look for information on a company, I can't find it on Twitter, or there's no one I can talk to, I will sort of have a look on the bulletin boards. Very rarely, though, and I know there can be quite a nasty place. A lot of trolls on there. You must get your fair share of flack, don't you, on there?
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I go on to, you know, LSC is that I've, you know, usually what I've got to say takes more than 140 characters and it's probably not worth that much time, but that's why I tend to go on the LSC. But yeah, just recently, like a lot of people, but I accept it. If I'm going to come out with some outspoken opinions and kind of, you know, keep going on and on about certain themes, then I'll get a lot of stick and I'll probably deserve, you know, 90% of it. It's funny, the psychology. I was chatting to a few other traders and investors, and because it has been so tough this last 2 months, it's been a really difficult market and people react differently, and but, you know, sometimes quite defensively. So the stick that anyone gets, often there's a direct correlation with how badly the markets are doing. When the markets are great, you know, and, you know, you're shooting fish in a barrel, everyone's happy and everyone wants to be your best mate and everyone's patting you on the back. And markets have been tough at the minute, and whether it's because I'm outspoken or whether I'm perceived to be doing better or doing quite well, I'm not too sure really. I think it's, I deserve it in a sense that if I'm going to go out there and say certain things and be quite vocal about those things, then I'll accept all the criticism. And if I've invested in a company and I've got 5 or 6 people saying why this company's bad, then that's fine, you know, that's part and parcel of it. So I don't really dismiss them as trolls. I just dismiss them as people who perhaps, you know, aren't doing so well themselves and sort of want to divert that negative energy. You know, and I'm not really that worth it. I'm really not worth the hassle. You know, go and spend your energy on people who are really doing well.
Yeah, well, and do you know what's odd? It's like, there is, I think, the natural reaction if someone criticises a company you're invested in, because even though it shouldn't be emotional, because there's money involved, people do get emotional. But I think, you know, the way to become a better investor, because I've seen people, you know, very good investors there, and someone will knock their company, and they won't slag them off, they won't get personal, they'll just, you know, go through the points the person's made, and they'll address them, you know, and that's the best way, I think, you know, because essentially, there's no point getting emotional. And I think sometimes, if someone points up a point to me about a company I own, and I didn't know that, I sort of appreciate that, you know, it's you know more about the risk then, you know, and rather than just getting emotional and getting personal, there's no point, is there?
Yeah, and I'll give you sort of two examples. You know, I came onto the podcast and I said, you know, number one, I will always listen to the doubters and to the cynics because they've often got more to say. Mm. But when it sort of becomes a little bit snide and seemingly personal, because out of all the tips and all the shares that I've mentioned over the last 8 weeks, one has seemed to have gotten people quite hot under the collar, which is Starcom. And I remember tipping that on my second podcast. And if people actually went and listened to it, at no point did I say it was a screaming buy. At no point did I say this will be your panacea and it will make lots of money. And at no point did I say it would make money quickly. I said it's a three-month buy, build and hold, which it is. Mm-hmm. I even tweeted my share purchases and screenshots of those purchases. I was accused of ramping it, accused of working for YA Global, accused of selling in when the share price rose to about 3 and a bit pence 4 weeks ago. And I think if people actually listen to what I said in the podcast, and it's that discrepancy between myth and reality.
Yeah.
You know, the myth is that I'm ramping some stock and selling out at some hefty price. And that their only point, I think three posters have spent about 170 separate posts talking about their reliance on YA Global, a point which I made on the podcast. They are reliant on YA Global.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they've got directors who hold 60%. They've got this Mitten fund who hold 11.9%. They've cut costs by $500,000 this year. So it's that difference between myth and reality. And I've just been getting a little bit of well-intentioned, I'm sure, and well-meaning stick. And out of all the companies that I've mentioned, not once have they sort of picked up on any of those negatives on any other company. So it seems to have divided opinion on Twitter world, my investment and continued support for Starcom as a risky buy, build and hold with caveats share tip.
Yeah, and I suppose some of those people are maybe, and they shouldn't, you know. I always send the podcast, in fact, the bits of audio at the end of the podcast say, please do your own research. People, you know, on the podcast could be invested in the stocks they talk about. And I suppose people have bought on your advice, and because the share price hasn't gone up, you know, spectacularly, they've got to find someone to blame. You know, that's the trouble. But that's why a huge industry has grown up around, you know, if there's blame, there's a claim, you know, because people, it's human nature not to accept blame. They want to blame somebody else, you know, it's the most natural thing in the world for people to do. But, you know, like everything, it's hard for everyone to do that, but there we are. Listen, I've seen Pipehawk, P-I-P, come up quite a lot. You've mentioned it on Twitter and stuff. And also, I've had I think two people have mentioned it as a stock with potential on a feature I do on the podcast. So take us through. I assume you own Pipehawk, do you?
Yeah, I've owned Pipehawk for about 12 months. I think I bought it back at 3 pence, and it rose to about 7 pence in sort of autumn time.
What do they do?
I made the mistake of not selling those, but so I held from 3p and added a bit more at 4. So they do kind of ground probing technology that you can use for utility companies, for mining companies. They also do bespoke equipment for engineering companies. A bit of a turnaround business. They do some turnkey solutions.
Yeah.
Directors hold a big chunk, and their last update said they've got about £12 million of probable orders for this quarter.
Oh, cool. All right, marvellous. And let's look at the share price. I was just looking at the share price of them. So they're at around about just over 4 pence. They spiked up to 8 pence, didn't they, back in October last year. But, you think they're forming a nice little bottom here, or what's happening?
I think it's forming a nice little channel again, but more importantly, it's because when the directors did their reports in December and said it had been a poor first two quarters to the financial year, but said that July to September had moved back to profitability. And I was just really impressed with their presentation that they did in December, saying, look, we've got £12 million worth of orders. Inquiry lines are at all-time high. They said that their inquiry issues in 2015 was because clients were stalling because of the Scottish referendum and the British general election. So larger companies were postponing orders until there was a certainty about the Scottish situation, because some of its key markets, have got Scottish clients. But they've just recently won a £600,000 contract with Hadley's Engineering, I think in October. Another £500,000 or £600,000 contract with Dana.
Yeah, I'm reading that now. And they're only at 1.3 million market cap, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the downside to that is they are still reliant on director loans. The director, Mr. Watts, has been bankrolling the company the last 3 or 4 years through a director loan. you can take that as a positive or a negative. Negative that they've not been able to get the free cash flow to start paying down that loan, or as a positive that the director clearly sees it's a worthwhile business. Yeah. What I like is that there's two private investors or net worth investors who both got to 9% in 2014. I don't recognise one of the names, but the other name is Mr. Lobbenberg. He also took a stake in another British engineering company called Transens Technology that do tyre pressure gauges. And they recently signed a contract. I think it was either Goodyear. It was one of the tyre manufacturers. So this Mr. Lobbenberg, who's clearly a sort of an activist investor, he's got 9%. Someone else has got 9%. And they've got three kind of parts of the company. And one of them is this QM. One of them is called Arden, and the other one, I'm trying to think off the top of my head now, I'll come to in a few seconds. So they've got these three parts of the business, Adian, that's the other one. And these three businesses have all got something to offer for the sort of highly specialised, bespoke engineering, say ground probing and sensor technologies. Just on the back of that presentation, they announced that first contract, the first of this sort of £12 million backlog that they are, quote unquote, highly confident of getting. Yeah. So it is quite volatile. It does swing and move quite in a volatile fashion. So, the normal market size, you might hear this being talked about as NMS, the normal market size. Yeah. It isn't something you would, as a newer investor, you wouldn't perhaps put more than, £500 or £1,000 in there. It's about the normal market size. I've got much more than that, and I'm comfortable sitting on that. But I think for new investors or new people to Pipehawk, I certainly wouldn't invest straight away. I would look at the company, look at the presentations, and see if you believe that a small, bespoke British engineering company has got the future it claims. That we are in a slightly wobbly financial situation. You've mentioned China. We've seen, the problems that Rolls-Royce and the other big engineering companies have had over the last 6 months. So it's not without risks. And you might think it's an odd choice to go for a British engineering company, given the fact that lots of British engineering companies' share prices and profitability have fallen. But for a 1.3 million capitalized company, it's not going to take much to get some free cash flow and to get some real momentum behind it.
Yeah. And like I said, the chart, at the highest price it's been. Like I said, it's at 4.3, and it seems like it very rarely dips in the last year. I'm looking at now, the last two years, it hasn't dipped below 4 a lot of the time. When it does, it punches back above that. So,
there's a nice range between 4 and sort of 6.5, yeah. 7 pence. I mean, I added myself. I bought some more last week. I think it was at 4.2 pence. So, despite the volatility and the drips of sales, particularly over the quiet Christmas period or post-Christmas, it seems to have been, the cheapest to buy for a while is, somewhere between 4.2 pence. And the bid price is pretty strong. But again, like any other tip, it's not something to go and buy straight away. It's something just to go away for a few weeks and research,
Exactly. You're spot on. You got to point that out. I mean, you have, to be fair, every time you come on here, you said, people, do some research. Don't go and buy this straight away. Do some research. And if you find your research, falling short, then don't buy the thing. And I always say this podcast is just, should be used as a stepping stone for further research. And that's it,
It is, and you don't want people to become lazy, and you still see it on Twitter. People are asking person X or person Y for their next tip, and within a few minutes that they're buying that, and I think people have to take responsibility. Yeah. And that's my big bugbear with the people who are criticizing it. At no point do any of the people on Twitter say go and buy this. It's up to everybody's responsibility to ask the question. So I think the next time I do a tip, just to keep the people on LSE happy, I think what I'll do is, the next tip I do, I'll list 10 negatives and one positive, and that'll be completely balanced then, and I'll put everybody off. So we'll do it that way. So please don't go buy Pipehawk. It's called PIP. It's not going to go anywhere. So I'm locked into that stock. and I'm desperate to get out, but I really don't see any future. Let's see what happens next, shall we?
Yeah, well, what I've just done while we're chatting there, I just put a price alert on there. So if it hits 4p, I'll be alerted, and it'll remind me to do some more research. I think, well, that's the bottom of the trading range there. I'll have a look at this. So, marvellous. Ridley, as ever, thanks very much for coming on, fella. And I'll put a link to your Twitter profile on sharepickers.com. Speak soon, fella.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. You take care.
That's it for the podcast. A bit of a marathon one. First time I've ever had 4 guests on the podcast. So I hope you stuck with it. If you're listening to this point right now, if you continue to listen, thank you very much. And by all means, go to voxmarkets.co.uk/app to download the app there. And there's a cracking little feature there. It's basically set up a watch list of companies. And then you have sent RNS releases straight to the front screen of your phone whenever they release some information. And also take part in the All Price Sweepstake. It's voxmarkets.co.uk/ops, O-P-S, All Price Sweepstake. The last submission will be on 4:30 on Thursday. And if you're correct in guessing the price of Brent crude oil at midday on Friday, you win that price in cash. If no one guesses it, it's a rollover. How exciting.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.